Let's kick it in order. Update on the Lower Russian River.
Mr. Chair, this is a long presentation, so I don't know if you want to take a quick, consider a quick break while the room clears.
Sure, why don't we do that?
I'm just going to be doing my...
Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning. Yes, okay, it is still the morning.
Still, technically, yes.
Good morning. I'm Rebecca Fitzgerald, supervisor of the TMDL unit, here to talk a little bit about item 13, which is an update on our Russian River-related regulatory and TMDL efforts. I'm just one of a team of your staff here, outnumbering you, who's working on regulatory and TMDL programs in the Russian River. And our purpose today is to present you with information on pathogenic bacteria and nutrient issues in the Russian River watershed and give you a better understanding of the scope and status of our permitting efforts, what sources still need to be addressed, what we don't have much information about yet, how we intend to fill that knowledge gap through total maximum daily loads and monitoring efforts, and what our initial TMDL analyses are showing us, and then, of course, how we intend to move forward. As you would expect, there are many programs and staff involved in the core regulatory and TMDL activities in the Russian River watershed. Therefore, this presentation is such a team effort. I'll be presenting an overview of the watershed, discuss a little bit about our water quality concerns and potential sources. Our core reg team of Ms. Kathy Goodwin, Ms. Lisa Bernard, Ms. Mona Doherty, and Mr. Charles Reed will discuss our existing regulatory programs and permits in the watershed, including those for publicly owned treatment works, wineries, food processors, dairies, our stormwater program, and then also get into private domestic wastewater treatment systems. Mr. Buckus and I will then follow with an overview of our upcoming monitoring efforts for the Russian River pathogen TMDL, and we'll also give you an update on some of our initial nutrient source analysis results we're seeing for the Laguna. And then I'll conclude with a discussion of our early TMDL implementation efforts and some next steps. You'll be seeing this slide several times through the presentation just to try to kind of keep us on track so you know who's talking about what. But first, just to orient everybody onto the Russian, obviously it's the watershed that we're sitting in right now. It starts up in Mendocino County, Porter Valley, Lake Mendocino, Potter Valley, pardon me, Lake Mendocino, coming down through the Ukiah area. This is the county line, Mendocino, and then Sonoma counties. This bend here is Healdsburg, Fitch Mountain, and then it kind of heads west out to Jenner and the Pacific. This here is the Laguna watershed, which we will be talking about, Lake Sonoma. As you'll remember from last time we talked to you about the TMDLs in July, there are several 303D impairments in the Russian River watershed. They include sediment and temperature across the watershed, reservoir listings in the two mercury listings in the two reservoirs, and a few others. Today, however, we want to focus on the pathogenic indicator bacteria listings and the nutrient listings. It's really going to be what we're here to talk about today. This map here goes into where our indicator bacteria impairments are. This is per the 2010 303D list. Just to run through them real quick, it's the highlighted streams in red. Up here in the Healdsburg area, there's an unnamed tributary that comes off of Fitch Mountain that's listed. The reach here of the main stem Russian River at Healdsburg Memorial Beach, and it's between the railroad bridge and the Highway 101 bridge, is the listed part. Also on the main stem is the reach in between Guerneville, Fife Creek confluence, to Dutchville Creek confluence in Monterio. And then the tributary systems of Santa Rosa Creek, the Laguna de Santa Rosa, and Green Valley Creek. And I just want to say that they're listed because concentrations of pathogenic indicator bacteria exceed levels that are deemed safe for water contact recreation. That's the beneficial use that's keyed into. The Laguna de Santa Rosa is also listed as impaired for nutrients, plus dissolved oxygen, temperature, and sediment. So what are the likely potential sources of pathogens and nutrients in the Russian River watershed? They include domestic, municipal, and industrial waste discharges, stormwater runoff, spills, homeless encampments and migrant worker camps, recreational users, and animals from dairy cows to deer. Of the sources on this list, some are currently being regulated, actually quite a few are, and permitted, and some are not. So what we want to do is follow with the discussion of our regulatory efforts. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Ms. Goodwin.
So good morning. My name is Kathy Goodwin. I am staff to the Regional Water Board, and I work in the Core Regulatory Unit. This next segment of the presentation will be an overview of the programs and work that is being done in the Core Regulatory Unit to protect water quality in the Russian River watershed. And we'll also highlight areas where work is needed to get a handle on potential sources of pollutants. I'm going to kick off this section with an overview of our work with the publicly owned municipal wastewater treatment facilities. This slide identifies 14 municipal wastewater treatment facilities in the Russian River watershed and also provides an overview of some of the regulations that apply to them. Most of the wastewater treatment facilities in the watershed are located adjacent to the river, as you can see on this slide. Municipal wastewater treatment facilities are closely regulated. All 14 facilities in the Russian River watershed are covered under a permit adopted by the Regional Water Board. The five blue circles identify the facilities that are covered under waste discharge requirements. These are land discharge-only facilities. And then the 9 red dots, and I can't point to them all because I've got Mona's head here, but they identify the NPDES facilities, and these are facilities that are under permit and authorized to discharge to surface waters. NPDES permits are adopted for a 5-year term to ensure a regular and thorough review of requirements for these facilities. All 14 of these facilities are enrolled under the statewide collection system permit that was adopted by the State Board in 2006. And this statewide order requires development of sewer management plans, repairs and upgrades of collection systems over time, and reporting and notification of spills. Many of these wastewater treatment facilities have occasional small spills of sewage that are usually cleaned up efficiently and properly reported. Large spills are not as common and usually occur during extreme winter weather conditions. The basin plan provides further regulations that protect water quality in this area, including prohibitions and limitations. All NPDES facilities in the Russian River watershed must provide advanced or tertiary level treatment. These two terms are used interchangeably, and this is for surface water discharges. The seasonal discharge prohibition limits surface water discharges to the period of October 1 through May 14th of each year. Therefore, there are no permitted discharges occurring during the summer recreation season, the dry season. The basin plan also limits the volume of treated wastewater that can be discharged to 1% of the receiving water flow rate, unless an exception has been granted. And Santa Rosa is the only discharger in the basin that has been granted an exception at this time. Another thing I wanted to point out is that most NPDES dischargers have the ability to manage their facilities to minimize the length of time they discharge to the river in the winter. They do this by trying to minimize the amount of effluent in storage at the beginning of the discharge season. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the common pollutants at wastewater treatment facilities and how these are addressed through permit requirements. I'll discuss primarily conventional pollutants, which are BOD, total suspended solids, and bacteria, and then also nutrients. All of our permitted facilities provide a minimum of secondary treatment that includes sedimentation and aeration to reduce suspended solids and biochemical oxygen demand to meet effluent limits set by regulation. NPDES facilities in the Russian River Basin are also required to provide a filtration step in the treatment process to achieve stricter tertiary requirements. Again, the basin plan calls these advanced requirements or advanced wastewater treatment for BOD, total suspended solids, and bacteria. All of the facilities in the Russian River watershed disinfect the final effluent to kill off or deactivate bacteria utilizing either chlorine or ultraviolet light disinfection to meet strict health-based standards for bacteria. As permits have been renewed in recent years, effluent and receiving water monitoring requirements for nutrients are included, including ammonia, nitrate, and phosphorus. And we evaluate for reasonable potential to have any impacts on surface water and groundwater. If data reveals levels of pollutants that could exceed water quality objectives, effluent limits and a compliance schedule are placed in the permit. Numeric water quality objectives for ammonia and nitrate that are currently used in our permits are toxicity criteria to protect aquatic life and human health uses. Currently, there are no water quality objectives for phosphorus. However, the basin plan contains narrative standards prohibiting discharges of biostimulatory substances, and these standards are all included in our permits. The most common methods for a discharger to comply with nitrogen-based effluent limits are source control and treatment. Most wastewater treatment facilities that utilize aeration accomplish some level of nitrification, which is the process that utilizes bacteria to convert ammonia to nitrate in the presence of oxygen. Nitrate removal is less common, although it is utilized in several facilities in the Russian River watershed. So we have some facilities that have pretty low levels of ammonia and nitrate in their effluent. The tertiary plants in the watershed may also be accomplishing some level of phosphorus removal, but this is difficult to quantify at this time since we only have phosphorus data for a handful of facilities and no influent data for these same facilities. These next three slides will provide specific details about the wastewater treatment facilities. Each of the tables, each slide will look just like this, and the tables identify, this pointer going, the average dry weather design flow on the top row of the middle column, and then the treatment level on the second row of the middle column. The third column identifies the disposal method or methods that are used by the facility. Footnotes are also identify enforcement issues and special compliance issues. And I'm not going to comment on every facility, but the slides are available in your agenda package for your closer review. So this particular slide focuses on the five northern facilities, again with red circles indicating NPDES facilities and blue indicating land discharge only facilities. Although this area of the river is not part of any of the TMDL listings that Rebecca mentioned, we wanted to include this area to make our overview of the wastewater treatment facilities in the watershed complete. All five northern facilities utilize year-round discharge of secondary effluent to percolation ponds located adjacent to or near the river. Ukiah also discharges tertiary effluent directly to the river during the winter months. These facilities generally operate in compliance with existing waste discharge requirements. Ukiah, Cloverdale, and Hopland have permit requirements to evaluate percolation ponds that they use to ensure compliance with the Basin Plan seasonal discharge prohibition. Other facilities with percolation ponds will be required to conduct a similar evaluation in the future. And while Hopland is a facility that historically failed to comply with its waste discharge requirements, it is in a rehabilitation process in order to achieve full compliance. Of the two NPDES facilities on this slide, Ukiah is working hard toward reducing ammonia and nitrate in its effluent, while Cloverdale has not yet collected any data, but will be addressing this in Cloverdale's permit renewal this year. The next five facilities are in more populated areas of the southern watershed. These five facilities generally operate in compliance with permit requirements. The three NPDES facilities, Healdsburg, Windsor, and Santa Rosa, have reliable tertiary systems with nitrification and denitrification and discharge high-quality effluent to the river or a major tributary of the river. Healdsburg has a real new treatment plant. It's a tertiary plant. Healdsburg is also under a cease and desist order to comply with the Basin Plan seasonal discharge prohibition and will begin construction of its reclamation system this year, allowing them to gradually move towards cessation of discharges to basalt pond during the discharge prohibition season. The four NPDES facilities shown on this slide are in the west part of Sonoma County. Two of the four provide tertiary treatment, and the other two, Grayton and Occidental, are under enforcement orders requiring upgrades to tertiary treatment if either discharger wishes to continue with surface water discharges into the future. Forestville upgraded to tertiary almost 7 years ago and generally operates in compliance with its current permit with occasional effluent limit violations. Forestville's upcoming permit renewal will address the need to monitor for nutrients. In recent years, Grayton's secondary plant has met tertiary effluent limitations for BOD and total suspended solids. However, a filtration process is needed to comply with Basin Plan requirements, and Grayton is under a cease and desist order to accomplish this. Grayton's nutrient monitoring has demonstrated that the effluent has relatively low concentrations of nitrate and ammonia and moderate levels of phosphorus. Occidental discharges secondary effluent year-round to a pond at the headwaters of Dutchville Creek that has been determined to be waters of the state. Occidental has ammonia levels that need to be addressed, and nitrate levels are low, indicating that there is little to no nitrification occurring at this particular plant. These issues will be addressed in Occidental's upcoming permit revision, which we also hope to bring to you this year. Funding is being sought to add storage and reclamation capacity at Occidental to convert this plant to a zero discharge facility. Russian River CSD's tertiary plant generally meets permit requirements, except occasionally during periods of sustained rainfall. There are plans to upgrade this facility with high flow storage basins and to improve disinfection by upgrading their chlorination facility to an ultraviolet light disinfection system. Russian River CSD's permit contains interim and final effluent limits for ammonia and nitrate and a schedule to comply with these effluent limits during the current permit term. This plant is also in an area of the lower river that experiences high levels of algae in the summer, and this area of the river does need further study. So I'd like to summarize my presentation by saying that through our permitting program, the municipal wastewater treatment facilities in the Russian River watershed are generally doing a good job of meeting effluent limits for BOD, total suspended solids, and bacteria that protect beneficial uses. While several of the facilities have come a long way with regard to nutrient control, staff will continue to work with all of the municipal plants to ensure that effluent nutrient levels are quantified and properly controlled to protect water quality. And we will coordinate these efforts with the TMDL unit staff. So now I'm going to turn the presentation over to Lisa Bernard, who is going to talk about our efforts with wineries, food processors, and dairies.
Good morning again. I'm Lisa Bernard, still. And I'm just going to give a brief overview of some of the food processors and producers, which includes dairies, and what our activities are ongoing in the Russian River Basin. So food processing and production activities can generate significant volumes of liquid wastes from water that is used for cleaning and sterilization of equipment, washing, and cooling. In addition to wastewater, food processing and production facilities generate solid waste such as skins, rejects, manure, and soiled bedding. The pollutants in these waste streams are primarily composed of biodegradable organic material, which we measure as BOD, some suspended solids, nitrogen in its several chemical forms, phosphorus, and bacteria. In the Russian River watershed, the North Coast region in general, waste streams from food production and processing are most often managed through best management practices and land application, where the pollutants in the waste stream are beneficially reused for the growing of crops. The primary goal of effective waste management is to apply these practices by limiting the quantity of pollutants that are available to impact surface and groundwater. I'm going to discuss just three sectors of our agricultural food processors and producers and the status of their regulatory oversight that we apply here. Let's see. So wineries constitute the largest sector of our agricultural community in Sonoma County. The Regional Water Board currently oversees 55 of the winery facilities, which we have identified thus far in the Russian River watershed, under our general waste discharge requirements, which were adopted in 2002. The general waste discharge requirements for wineries only addresses the production end of the waste stream and does not cover any domestic waste stream that might be associated with a winery, such as, you know, restrooms and those kind of things. So to comply with the general order, facilities must apply best management practices for the handling of their pumice, processed rinse water, wine, and other processed wastes. These wastes are generally contained in piles or holding ponds for seasonal land application on croplands. Monitoring of the liquid waste stream is required for BOD, suspended solids, and dissolved oxygen. The general permit does not limit nor require the monitoring of nitrogen, phosphorus, or bacteria in the waste streams. And they also do not require any groundwater monitoring, for example. All right. So we changed the picture a little bit here, so I just want to orient you to the map. We have Timbercrest Farms here, which is just to the north and west of the city of Healdsburg. And here we are showing six of our seven permitted food processing facilities in the region. The other one is located in Humboldt County. There are likely more food processors in the region that we do not have under permit. These have come to us under varying circumstances to our attention, and that's why these are under permit, but there perhaps are others in the sector that may do similar processes. So waste regulated under these permits are generally from fruits and vegetables to meat and poultry processing. Each one is regulated under a site-specific permit. Five of these facilities discharge to land, and the other one, which is Sonoma West Holdings, this one here, also has an NPDES permit, which allows them to discharge to surface water, but they generally manage their facility in such a way that they haven't needed to discharge to surface water in over 10 years. So these facilities are taking their waste and basically containing them until seasonal land application can occur. None of these permits contain nutrient limitations or bacteria requirements for monitoring. So we'll talk just briefly about the dairies in the Russian River watershed. This map shows that we have 23 dairies in the southern Russian River watershed. We have not identified any dairies at this time in the Russian River above approximately Healdsburg. So, and as you can see, all but three of our dairies are actually located within the Laguna sub-watershed. The focus, as we said this morning, of the new dairy program will be the application of best management practices through the nutrient management plans. There will be monitoring and reporting for nitrogen and phosphorus content. And the idea is to minimize the availability of those constituents to surface and groundwater through the reuse of the waste stream for at agronomic rates to minimize, to provide for sustainable agriculture and minimize the pollutants that could be impacting beneficial uses. So that's just in brief what we're going to talk about there. I'm going to hand it over to Mona Doherty, and she's going to tell us a little bit about stormwater.
Good morning. I'm Mona Doherty, and I work in the stormwater program. I wanted to take a brief moment to recognize all the beautiful maps that you see in our presentation that were provided by our intern, Forrest Fortescue, and he worked many late nights and provided us all with these really nice visual aids. In the NPDES stormwater program, we have three oversight and permitting programs, construction, industrial, and municipal. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I went back around.
Bottom line. There we go.
Sorry about that. We do have industrial, construction, and municipal. And first I want to talk about construction. In the construction stormwater program, a new general permit was adopted by the State Board in September 2009 for covering private and public construction sites over 1 acre in size. The permit includes new requirements to reduce sediment discharge from construction sites, such as more detailed pollutant control plans, inspections, and monitoring. There's also a new electronic application, and due to some temporary growing pains, there may be potentially a significant number of non-filers. But at this time, we do have approximately 90 permitted sites in the Russian River watershed, as you can see on this map. The State Board is trying to resolve the issue if there are significant number of non-filers. Projects under 1 acre do not need permit coverage, but must comply with a basin plan. And the regional board does not have an oversight program for these projects under an acre. In the current industrial stormwater permit that was adopted by the State Board in 1997 is being renewed currently, and they're going to provide a general permit for several different industries, actually many different industries. I just provided some examples here. The current permit requires BMPs to limit introduction of pollutants to stormwater runoff, monitoring of the first flush storm event, and annual reporting. We have 177 permitted sites in the Russian River watershed, and some examples of these industries are pulp and wood mills, asphalt and ready mix plants, mining operations, wrecking yards, airports, landfills, many manufacturing industries, and wastewater treatment plants. There are some businesses that are not covered that may be of concern to the Russian River impairments. And some examples of these are kennels, commercial stables, boarding facilities, nurseries, landscaping stores, winery pumice, and some composting operations, farm supply, and home improvement stores. And finally, I'd like to discuss the municipal stormwater program. In this map, the areas outlined in red have municipal stormwater coverage. In this program, permittees are required to minimize the discharge of pollutants from their storm drain systems. They use BMPs to control pollutants from new development and construction, municipal operations, spills and discharges, and give the public information on how they can help. We have 9 permitted municipalities in the Russian River watershed. Most are within the Laguna. The Phase 1 permittees are under a permit adopted by the regional board, have been under permit longer, and have more robust programs with BMPs to address impairments such as inspections for nurseries. The Phase 2s are covered under a general permit adopted by the state board, which is currently being renewed, and they have generally less developed programs. As you can see, most of the Russian River watershed is not covered under the municipal stormwater program. There are some local controls on stormwater, such as the Mendocino County has recently adopted a countywide stormwater ordinance, and Sonoma County adopted a countywide grading ordinance. And the future of the municipal program will focus on BMPs to target pollutants and activities that contribute to impairments and to aid in TMDL implementation. And at this time, I'd like to pass off to my esteemed colleague, Charles Reed.
Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Charles Reed, Water Resource Control Engineer here at the board. I'm going to be going over the state of our oversight of private domestic wastewater treatment systems. Earlier, Kathy Goodwin provided a nice overview of the publicly owned treatment systems in the Russian River watershed. As Kathy noted, all these POTWs are currently regulated under individual waste discharge requirements for their wastewater treatment facilities, and since 2006, general waste discharge requirements for their sanitary sewer systems. Each of these permitted publicly owned treatment works have monitoring reporting programs, effluent monitoring, and groundwater monitoring requirements. So staff are confident that for these facilities, there are adequate controls to protect water quality. For the private wastewater treatment systems, it's a different picture. In contrast to publicly owned treatment works, the universe of private domestic wastewater treatment systems is large, ranging from small systems for individual residences to large systems over 30,000 gallons per day. And the set of systems under permit is relatively small compared to the total number of private wastewater treatment systems, with only 23 under permit in the Russian River watershed. There are no surface water discharges from these private wastewater treatment plants, therefore requiring no MPDS permits. Discharges from these facilities are treated generally in pond systems prior to discharge through irrigation or percolation, or discharged directly to the subsurface through septic leach field systems. Many of the private systems have been under individual waste discharge requirements for years. Most of the newer wastewater discharges permitted since 2002 have been enrolled under the statewide general permit for small domestic systems. Commonly, these private systems only come to our attention as a result of an expansion or repair to the existing facility, where the regional board is reviewing the project under as part of a CEQA review with another local agency being the CEQA lead. Another way they come to our attention is through complaints and spills or referrals from local regulatory agencies. For the purpose of this presentation, the list of private domestic wastewater treatment facilities can be broken down into large systems, small to medium-sized systems, and residential systems. Large private systems, generally those systems are greater than 20,000 gallons per day, they're not common in the Russian River watershed. We just have a few, and I've listed a couple here, Bohemian Grove, Vintners Inn, Mayakama Golf Course, and the Luther Burbank Center are four largest private systems. The balance of the private systems are small to medium-sized systems, and they can be grouped in a flow range of 1,500 gallons to 20,000 gallons per day. And since 2002, systems of this size that have applied for waste discharge requirements have routinely been enrolled under the statewide general permit. And facilities in this size range in the Russian River watershed are primarily campgrounds, but we also have two community systems, three inns, and two farm labor housing systems under permit. But there is a large number of private facilities for which there are currently no waste discharge requirements issued by the state. Types of facilities not currently permitted by the regional board include campgrounds and RV parks, which can pose a heightened threat to water quality because they're often located adjacent to water courses. Mobile home parks. There are over 130 in the Russian River watershed alone, although more than half of those are connected to POTWs. Summer camps. They can be a threat because they're subject to large seasonal waste loads. There are conference facilities, schools, hotels, lodges, and restaurants, which are also subject to large spikes in loading and high-strength waste. And finally, food production and processing facilities, which include wineries with tasting room facilities. For these types of facilities, staff have the usual regulatory tools. We can use a statewide general waste discharge requirements for small domestic systems, which is common for systems less than 20,000 gallons a day. For systems not qualifying for the general permit or where the location or nature of the discharge poses an increased threat to water quality, we can have the board consider and adopt individual waste discharge requirements. There's also an option of using conditional waivers. This option would typically be used for small discharges less than 3,000 gallons a day where the discharge poses a low threat to water quality. And for conditional waivers, there also was a requirement for routine monitoring, and the waivers have to be renewed every 5 years. But by far the greatest number of private systems in the Russian River watershed not directly regulated by the state are residential wastewater systems, where waste disposal systems consist of a septic tank and leach field, and wastewater flows are less than 1,500 gallons per day. This group includes single and multiple family residences, vacation rental homes, systems treating domestic waste from small commercial systems. These systems are most commonly regulated under county regulations in accordance with the Basin Plan's on-site systems policy. At the county level, on-site systems are approved through use permits or actively regulated by the county under operational permits for alternative systems. However, many existing systems predate local and state septic regulations, and consequently not much is known about these systems. To better understand our information gaps and identify potential problem areas within the Russian River watershed, staff is undertaking a GIS mapping project to identify waste discharge requirements on a parcel-by-parcel basis. Staff has been coordinating with county permitting agencies, health departments, municipalities, and the Sonoma County Assessor's Office to generate this map. And staff are hoping that these maps will identify clusters of residences using on-site wastewater treatment systems, where the simple density of the on-site systems may result in a cumulative impact to water quality. We hope that we can identify areas where site conditions are not ideal for on-site wastewater treatment systems, and importantly, reveal areas where on-site systems are not currently permitted by the county, or where there is a developed parcel where there is no information about what type of waste disposal is occurring. The following slide is a snapshot of an area along the Russian River that illustrates our mapping approach. But before I move to the next slide, I'd like to begin with some caveats. The project is a work in progress, and there are still some significant data gaps, and we're working on verifying what information we have on some of the parcels. So this snapshot is of the river communities of Oddfellows, Summer Home Park, Hollydale, and Hacienda. The objective of this mapping effort is to find out what we know about waste discharge requirements in the watershed and what we don't know. First, what we do know, to the left here is the community of Odd Fellows. This is an existing community system that's currently under waste discharge requirements. Highlighted in gray, and you can see here in gray, here. These are vacant, undeveloped parcels, and we're assuming there's no waste discharges from these parcels. Another group of parcels highlighted in green, you can see scattered through there. These are parcels where there's been record of contact with the Sonoma County Permit and Resource Management Department. In some cases, the on-site systems have been reviewed and approved by the county, and there even may be an operational permit for the system. But in other cases, there's only been a record of a contact with the county regarding sewage disposal, and there's really not any certainty what kind of system is on the parcel. And Regional Board staff has been is in the process of reviewing county records to verify the status of these systems. And finally, what remains, and I hope comes to your attention quickly, is the parcels highlighted in red. And these are parcels with residences, known residences, according to the Sonoma County assessor, where there's no information available about what kind of system is on it. The absence of information itself is useful information because we can assume that the on-site systems serving these parcels are old and don't currently meet county code or basin plan minimum siting and design requirements, and as a result, present a higher risk that they're contributing to water quality impairment of the Russian River. Our preliminary work on the subject, on the project, indicates that other areas along the Russian River where the densities of residential septic systems similar to Summer Home Park area have the same septic system parcel maps that would look similar to this. Monterio, Fitch Mountain, we would imagine they would look quite a bit like this if we had presented those to you today. And Jenner. And over the coming months, Region Water Board staff will be working to complete this effort for the Russian River watershed to help the development of the Russian River pathogen TMDL. And I believe Rebecca is going to take it from here.
Pass that little clicker back. Well, like Charles just said, I kind of want to bring us back to the TMDL efforts that we're doing a little bit. As you know, I think I've been following the GIS mapping work that Charles has just seen. It's kind of made me a little bit more and more aware of the known unknowns, so to speak, that are out there. And the TMDLs, hopefully, as we start doing our monitoring and our assessment work, will help fill in those knowledge gaps more and more. So I'm going to talk first about the Russian River Indicator Bacteria or Pathogen TMDL, Total Maximum Daily Load, and then I'll talk a little bit about the Laguna. I want to bring us back to the map of where the indicator bacteria impairments are in the Russian. The Russian River TMDL will obviously address these listed reaches that are shown here, but we're also expanding our focus with the TMDL to include more of the river, roughly from around Cloverdale down to the mouth at Jenner. And also several of the tributaries. We've seen monitoring data showing indicator bacteria levels that are higher than what is safe for recreation within that Cloverdale to Jenner run, so that's why we're expanding the scope. And this is pretty much also in anticipation that we will propose an expanded listing in the 2012 303D list update. We are currently pretty early in the process of developing the Russian River Pathogen TMDL. We're about to start a pretty comprehensive monitoring effort that's going to go for the next year. And we designed that monitoring effort around the recommendations of researchers from the UC Davis Aquatic Ecosystems Laboratory and their Russian River Pathogen Pilot Study. We commissioned this pilot study to provide us with monitoring recommendations to help improve detection, quantification, and our methods as we go.
In order to make those monitoring recommendations, though, the UC Davis researchers, they monitored for indicator bacteria, Bacteroides, stable isotopes, and they also conducted a spatial land use analysis. And this was all within the lower Russian River watershed over about a six-month period of time between December of 2008 and May of 2009. Some of the preliminary results of this monitoring effort are presented here. They include the indicator bacteria levels exceeded thresholds for the protection of water contact recreation throughout the lower Russian River study area, that bacteria levels were lower in streams that drained semi-rural land uses than in streams that drained urban land uses, that when rainfall increased, the levels of indicator bacteria increased, and that indicator bacteria from human sources were present in significant concentrations in the streams that drained ag and urban land uses. For more information about the results of this pilot study, the location of the sites that they sampled from, and a lot of other good information, I want to refer you to our Hot Off the Presses summary report. There should be some copies out on the lobby table, and it's up on our website as well. So we're looking forward to conducting a very comprehensive, like I said, monitoring effort this year. And we will hope it will help explain the real complex relationships between indicator bacteria, pathogens, and sources to a much greater degree. And help to explain some of these initial results that we saw with the pilot study, which we have found to be very interesting. But the main reason that we did commission this study was to help us provide us with the recommendations for this monitoring effort. And just a summary of the recommendations are listed here. We're going to be, it recommended we expand the parameters that we look at to not just the standard suite of indicator bacteria, but also the Bacteroides and the stable isotope analysis, to increase our sampling frequency, to include holiday weekends, more in the wet season, to sample a range of flows from low flows to first flush events to storm flows and late winter pulses. And our monitoring effort is going to be doing all these. I'm going to actually turn the mic now over to Steve Butkus to really give you some of the details of what our monitoring effort is going to look like.
Excuse me, Rebecca. I'm pretty sure I know, but would you explain the significance of the increase during rainfall events? Why does this happen?
I don't think I can explain it. I think we need to do some more monitoring before we'll have a better explanation for it. It's very complex. I don't know. Do you have some thoughts on that you want to share? I think it's, you know, we think it's coming in with the stormwater, but we definitely want to do more monitoring. This was a little taste, and you know, it's difficult to try to tease it all out.
Thank you.
Oh, great. Good morning. I'm Steve Butkus. I'm an environmental scientist working in the TMDL unit, and I've been doing some of the technical analysis on this and the Laguna TMDL. Based on the UC Davis recommendations for monitoring, we designed a monitoring plan to answer these general management questions. Are the basin plan water quality objectives being met? We have a couple indications here and there. We've got a few listings based on some of this monitoring data, but we really don't know the full extent of this up and down the river. We've been just monitoring a few locations here and there. What is the variability of these indicator bacteria? It's known in the literature that bacteria are extremely variable in the environment, and we really haven't assessed that. Most of our sampling has been single sample grabs from one location. We go back other times, but we really don't know the variability of that grab sample. And a lot of our listings are based on that type of data. So part of the UC Davis recommendations is get more samples, do some variability studies. What are the more significant sources that these bacteria are coming from? And what are the natural background levels? We know wildlife contributes as well. They can be a significant source in other TMDLs. And so we have to assess, you know, between humans and human activities, as well as the wildlife background. And finally, do the beach areas where most people recreate in the summer, do they pose a higher risk to based on these bacteria than other areas? Is there a concentration of bacteria perhaps where people are recreating? So we've designed a monitoring plan to try to address these questions. The analytes that we're measuring for this monitoring plan include the E. coli bacteria and the Enterococcus bacteria. Those are the traditional pathogenic indicator bacteria that are monitored up and down the river to decide whether or not there's a risk to swimming. The Department of Health has regulatory criteria that will post beaches that exceed these the criteria for these bacteria, and our listings are based on those kind of data. We've added, based on the UC Davis recommendations, to include Bactroides bacteria. It's a different kind of bacteria that, I wanted to say the last two bacteria, we are going to be doing that assessment in our own regional office laboratory here. We are trying to become certified to do those assessments instead of purchase those services from a commercial lab. The cost is about a third what a commercial lab can do, so it allows us to do a lot more monitoring. It also allows us to do monitoring at times that a commercial lab would not accept samples. They typically only collect samples Monday through Thursday, and we have to do some weekend work and storm event work with this. So we are engaged in getting our lab certified to do those first two analyses. The Bactroides bacteria, that's another type of bacteria that is specific to the host animal. From that bacteria, we can tell whether that came from a cow or a human or some other wildlife, birds perhaps, their environment. So it's a new indicator that we haven't been involved with. A lot of it's somewhat researchy in the sense that we are setting up helping the Sonoma County Health Lab to do this analysis, and we have a contract with UC Davis researchers to help them optimize their equipment to actually perform this analysis within this basin, kind of to build the capacity to be able to do this more often instead of trying to send samples all the way across state. We did get funding to do the phylochip analysis, and I discussed that with the board about 6 months ago. This is a new technology that's coming out of National Berkeley Lab. We got some limited funding to get some of those samples. It's an exciting new technology because it quantifies everything out there using DNA extraction techniques. And what this does is it actually measures the pathogens that we're interested in. Their samples are expensive to do it, so we have a limited number, but it sort of gives us a little bit more background that instead of just looking at indicator bacteria, we can actually look at the whole microbiome that's out there. It's very important, powerful information.
Steve, maybe you can give us a quick update on that. I do remember you gave us a description of what that provided, and it sounded really exciting, but it did give you the full spectrum, and there I seem to remember a number of 50,000.
50,000 different organisms.
Yeah.
They have to be bacteria. They do not detect the viruses that might be out there, or any of the upper euglenoid kinds of pathogens, anything, but it does give us a good indication of everything, all the other bacteria sources that are out there.
I think I remember you had suggested that there were some efforts to try to be able to narrow that down so you could do the same type of analysis but have a more focused result and for less cost.
I think we're part of that. That's a little bit researchy on their side.
Okay.
They'll probably do all the full microbiome, but what we're trying to do is determine which sets of organisms really orient you to a certain type of source. And they've got some really interesting They use a statistical technique called ordination that allows you to look at clusters of communities and actually focus them. And they've been able to actually find communities and go right back to an individual, like, septic system.
Wow.
Sort of thing, that they have that much of a personal fingerprint. So it's pretty exciting new technology. We're not, we're very curious as to what it's going to do and to give us with this.
Sure. Thanks.
And then you realize the buzz that you created behind you.
And then the final thing that we will be looking at are the stable isotope analysis. And what this does is it allows us to look at the source of the water. It tells us whether the nitrate in the water has gone through an anaerobic process or if it's generated more from an overland flow and maybe a manure-type process. So it kind of tells us a little bit more information about where the water is coming from. The tasks that we intend to do for this monitoring, the first task is to do the sampling variability task. We're going to look at between laboratories, between sites, and between samples. We just really need to assess all components of the variability of the component of indicator bacteria because we've been basing a lot of our work on single samples up to now. We are going to look at the temporal and spatial variability. Up and down the river, we're going to look at both wet and dry periods. And we've got 18 locations along the river that we'll be doing that. We got a special task where we're looking at specific land uses. Here's where we have identified smaller little watersheds that have a predominance of a particular land use. And we will be monitoring both wet and dry runoff from those different types of land use to be able to discern those differences. We got the five land use categories that we've decided to look at are the forest land and the brush and scrub land. Those are the semi-natural areas that tend to be at the higher ends of the watershed that really have not been developed by man. And then we're looking at agriculture, high density residential, your urban sewered areas, and then your low density residential areas, perhaps your more rural areas on septic systems. And then the final task we're going to look at is the beach. And we're going to look at a couple of beaches, and we're going to look at a week-long intensive monitoring. Does bacteria levels increase during the weekend when more people are recreating at that beach? Is the cause of that, if there is an increase at the beach, is it coming from upstream? Is it being carried downstream? So we're going to be really intensively looking at a couple of beaches. The two listed beaches, Monterio and Healdsburg Memorial Beach, are listed, and they do get high recreation, so those are the ones we'll focus on. This is a map showing the locations of where we'll be doing this monitoring, or we plan to right now. We're going all the way upstream of Cloverdale for a site. There's some indication there might be some bacteria problems, and we're going all the way down to, there should be a site there, but at Jenner. And then these are some of the traditional beach sites that we've done here, and we've also got some of our listed waters there that we'll be doing the spatial temporal. The sample variability, we'll be just focusing on three listed reaches. The land use assessment, you can see they're kind of clustered down here in the lower basin. That they represent specific land uses. We have the same land uses that are represented up here, but we've kind of clustered our sampling efforts down closer to the board because of logistical and travel reasons. We have a six-hour holding time for these samples before we have to get them to the lab, and so it is more difficult to get samples further away to the lab in time. And then we'll be doing the beach use assessments at the two Healdsburg and Monterio reaches. We have developed a monitoring plan, and it is put in the form of a quality assurance project plan. It is currently under review by the state quality assurance officer. There's a couple of details that we're still working out with them. We expect to have that done shortly, and we will be posting it on the website for everybody to see the details, more further details.
Just quickly get into the schedule here for the Russian River TMDL. Steve mentioned that we're working on certifying our lab. We got to get the QAP finalized, and we got to do a few more little things on that. So it's probably going to happen around April, and then we're going to start monitoring soon thereafter, so in May. And then we're going to go straight through the summer and into the winter season, so we'll be through the winter of this coming year. Then we want to try to get the data analyzed and a monitoring report out next summer. And you'll probably see the draft TMDL out for public review in the early part of 2013. So that's kind of the schedule that we're looking at there. And with that, I thought I would then transition over to talk a little bit about our efforts in the Laguna watershed. There we go. For the Laguna, we're looking at the entire watershed, the Mainstem Laguna, Santa Rosa Creek, Marquess Creek, and Windsor Creek are all tributaries to it. So that includes the towns of Windsor, Santa Rosa, Roanoke Park, Cotati, and Sebastopol. And we're looking at quite a few impairments, the nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, the low dissolved oxygen levels, and also temperature and sediment within this watershed. We're further along with our Laguna TMDL efforts. We finished our monitoring and data collection efforts last year. And over the last few months, we've been really cranking on analyzing the data that we have and developing our source analysis first for the nutrient portion of the TMDL. And I'm going to turn it right back to Mr. Buckus to tell you a little bit of what our initial results are starting to show.
So in 2000, we did a similar thing as I had just described. We located little watersheds. They tend to be at the higher ends of the watershed that had a prevalence of particular land uses, basically 50% or great. Although some of these smaller watersheds like the forested and brush scrubland, we were able to find watersheds that 100% of the watershed was listed as that land use category. Some of the other ones are a little bit smaller percentages. But so anyway, we did go out in 2009 and collect both wet and dry period runoff from each of these particular types of land uses from little watersheds that these represent. And we based the definition of where these things are based on the 2006 USGS National Land Use Category. They're pretty general categories. They're not as specific as you'd like, but we wanted to do the assessment for the full watershed, so we generalized those. This is what it currently looks like based on those land use categories. We have a lot of forested undisturbed land still out there. Most of that is in the headwater areas of the Laguna. A lot of area has been converted to cropland and pasture, and those tend to be down here along the water of the Laguna on the lower ends. We do have a lot of brushland and scrublands. That's also a semi-natural undisturbed areas, and those tend to be again in the headwaters up on top, and that's actually defined as rangeland in that graphic and scrublands there. But it's the USGS defines it as rangeland, and it really is sort of your manzanita type of brush that they're talking about that is non-developed, and then orchards and vineyards, and then a number of residential areas. There. That's what we're currently working with, and we did monitor the runoff, both wet and dry period, from each of these land uses in 2009. We sampled that in a random kind of pattern so that the data that we get are representative of that particular category. And here's some of the results that we found. These are loading rates. These are pounds of phosphorus per acre per year. I'm going to be presenting phosphorus data here. We did collect the whole suite of nutrients, nitrogen in all forms and phosphorus in forms. But total phosphorus, just to give you an indication of how these results are showing. And our initial indication is that total phosphorus is the nutrient that is limiting the eutrophication and algal impacts in the basin that we're trying to control for the dissolved oxygen. So phosphorus is probably the nutrient that we will need to control in this watershed. What you see right off is the rates coming off of natural lands are very high compared to other ones. And that's because we do have a very highly erodible watershed. It's naturally erodible. We have those sorts of things. And the total phosphorus is associated with fine sediment, and that's why you see these large loading rates during wet. But you also see during the dry periods, they're really significantly lower, and these are rates. To compare the wet and dry periods, since the rates are so extreme, the axis on the right or the axis on the left is 30 times greater than the axis on the right. And I just wanted to bring this up to show you the patterns that are involved in here. What's partially very interesting is the orchard and vineyard wet period loading rates are really fairly low compared to everything else. And that indicates that perhaps the BMPs that are being applied in those areas are very effective. But for the dry period, you also see some kind of an opposite effect. You have basically your agricultural loading rates are much higher than most everything else, and your natural ones are very low. Dry period loading rates for eutrophication are the most important critical parameter. A lot of the loading that comes in during the wet season actually just continues out the river and ends up in, you know, the ocean, whereas the wet period or the dry period loading here, that is the stuff that's directly contributing to the algal impacts that we're seeing in the summer. So even though you have a lot of loading occurring during wintertime, the summer loading, the dry period loadings, are the most important effect on that eutrophication. Another way to look at this is go ahead and take those loading rates, because we know that, and that's a per acre rate, and just multiply that out by the number of acres that we know in the entire watershed to get a total loading rate. So this is the total loading rate for the entire watershed. And you see very much the similar kind of patterns of, you know, you do have high loading rates occurring during wet period from some of the natural areas. And you also see the same pattern for the dry periods. And in particular, the cropland and pasture areas have a significant load during the dry period compared to all other sources. So that helps us a little bit to say, okay, maybe the activities that are occurring in these kinds of land areas, land covers, we need to look at and focus on a little bit more to see why do we have a higher dry period load for those land covers. Another way to look at this is, the total load. I wanted to kind of put this a little bit in perspective to some other types of loads that you know of. And so these are the loads, the total loads come for each of these different land covers. And on the far right here, I've compared the Santa Rosa and the Windsor discharge loads for total phosphorus for a period of 4 years. This is actually after, for Santa Rosa, after 2003. That's after a lot of the diversion to the geysers project. So this is more recent type of data prior to that. But you can also see that, you know, the loading rates, the loading coming off of the land cover are on the same orders of magnitude as wastewater loads in the same watershed. To kind of give us a little bit more feeling as to what target should we shoot for, certainly we have these large loads coming off these landscapes, but we've had considerable conversion of land by man, you know, for management practices. So we went through an analysis here to determine what pre-settlement land covers were prior to a lot of this development. We're defining pre-settlement here as the early 1800s, just prior to the public land surveys of about 1850, when they platted the land and actually did conversions and homesteading. This analysis does not include the period, you know, 1600 and 1700s, when the Spanish were also managing those lands. We did this land cover assessment, pre-settlement land cover assessment, based on soil types, land forms, historical maps, survey records from the public land survey, a number of different things to sort of give us sort of what we think the pre and settlement laguna look like. Some very interesting things. A lot of the old, it's actually quite a large lake was out there that doesn't exist today because we have drained it. And I mean, there were significant amount of water. There's a lot of perennial wetlands surrounding these lakes and riverine wetlands that have all been converted. And most of this area in here, the oak savanna vernal pools, that was really low, very low concentration of nutrients come off there, and they actually does provide a lot of good treatment. So many of the areas that were removing the sediment loads and phosphorus loads coming off the higher mountains it used to be processed through here, and kind of pollutant loads were removed before it hit the Laguna proper. A lot of this land has been converted to cropland and agriculture at this point. So using these pre-settlement land covers and those rates and the loading rates that we were measuring before, as well as some in the literature, we were able to sort of determine, okay, what were the loads back in pre-settlement times and compare them to what we're measuring today. And we see there's significant increase in the amount of load. This is the total load coming off for a median year. Pre-settlement, we had, you know, 20,000 or so. There was significant wetland assimilation. It almost reduced it 70 to 80%, so that there was very little load left when the water, after it came off the mountainside and went through the wetlands and into the receiving waters, we had really significantly low phosphorus loads. Currently, we have a very, because of the land conversion, we have a really high load coming off. We still have a pretty good wetland assimilative capacity, maybe on the same order as we did before. Even though there are fewer wetlands, they're more efficient at removing so much load. When you put so much in there, it's easier for it to remove a significant amount as opposed to, you know, very little. They remove that. But you see, we're still having significant loads as compared to pre-settlement times. Another way of looking at the total loads is to convert that information into a concentration, because we can assess what the runoff is in wet and dry periods, because we have historical record, to convert that load back to a concentration so we can compare to criteria that are out there that are also concentration based. And that's what I've done here. This graphic is a return frequency graphic. It's the dry years are down here, and so this is the prediction that we're having of what the phosphorus concentration hit in receiving waters is during a dry year currently versus a wet year. And you can see it increases a couple, 30-40%. That this is like a low duration curve, but with concentration based. This return frequency is based on a 74-year period. And I've shown, you know, 2008 tended to be at this return frequency, and 2005, very wet year, was there. Compare this to pre-settlement concentrations that we're predicting from the same loads, and they're way down here running at about 10 to 15 micrograms per liter versus, so almost no order of magnitude difference, lower. And I plotted the little red line there, and that's the EPA equal regional criteria for this area. It's a it's not a objective, official objective. It's a recommended criteria for which you should try to achieve. And frankly, you know, pre-settlement times we were achieving that criterion, and now we're way above it. So this really directs us to the fact that we do have significant loading coming off of the landscape based on the conversion of the land for human uses. I think. Oops, what did I do there? I'll give you that. That was the last one.
Did you catch all that, everybody?
Yeah. It's like, it was down to the last slide. Very back. Yeah, there's that one.
There we go. I just want to conclude all of this a little bit with the next steps for the Laguna TMDL. As you might expect, we're really excited to see what these initial results are starting to show us. We want to continue to look at the data, do some more analysis, and continue to refine our source analysis results. But we're also starting to work a little bit on our linkage analysis, which will evaluate the link between the sources and the resulting conditions in the water body. And we're going to do that with a focus, I think Steve kind of already alluded to, but the summertime, real critical conditions out there in the Laguna where we see the eutrophication happen. Then we're going to start also working on developing our target conditions. We're going to try to estimate nutrient and dissolved oxygen regimes in the Laguna, kind of under what properly functioning conditions might result in. We're also going to be looking at fish habitat requirements. It's going to be steelhead and possibly coho in the tributaries, and also look at some of what the warm water species in the main stem are going to require. So that's still all in front of us. Then try to tie all that together with loads and load allocations. We really are focusing on the nutrient dissolved oxygen piece now. Once we're done with that, we want to move into the sediment and temperature and those analyses, and then really hammer down on the implementation plan. As we go through the rest of this TMDL development process, we really want to continue to be involved with the stakeholders that are in the watershed. We cannot do what we're doing here in a vacuum, and we've already come up with a stakeholder plan for the Laguna, and we really feel it's critical for our success to be involved with the community. We want to continue to inform them, communicate what's going on, and also solicit their input. This is really going to become key when we start working on the implementation plan in particular. Our schedule is up here. Like I kind of mentioned, we want to have our stakeholder involvement ongoing throughout this process. We are working on the nutrient and DO pieces, hope to have that wrapped up more by this summer, then move into the sediment and temperature technical work this fall, and then into the implementation plan this fall into next year. Hopefully we can have the draft TMDL out for public review next spring. So that's what we're shooting for right now. Because it takes several years for a TMDL to be developed and take effect, we often talk about early TMDL implementation efforts, work that can be done in a shorter time frame. But to kind of tie us all back again, in many ways, your staff are already working in a variety of regulatory programs to address known and likely sources of nutrients and pathogens in the Russian River watershed. We are going to continue our regulatory and permitting efforts, and they will remain key implementation components of the TMDLs as well. That said, for the Russian and Laguna watersheds, we do see the need to do some additional early implementation work. We want to work with the Sonoma County Water Agency to install some portable toilets at beaches along the Russian. We want to start engaging with homeless advocates and also the winery industry regarding migrant worker camps. You've also heard today that there are likely discharges that we don't know too much about. We intend for the TMDLs to help fill these knowledge gaps and give us a better understanding of in-stream conditions to help identify sources and clarify what implementation measures are necessary and really help us prioritize where our work needs to be. Oh, I guess I should have been on this slide the whole time I was talking. But I'll wrap up. I'll put up our contact information. One thing I want to point out here is that the mailing list link is for an email distribution notice, especially for those who are in the audience. We welcome you to sign up so you can hear about things as we get more information and documents are out for public review and meetings happen, that sort of thing. So we're happy to answer any questions, take any comments.
Thanks, Rebecca. Mr. Massey.
Thank you. The first thing I want to do is say thank you very, very much for an immense amount of staff work that I know has gone into this, particularly for those of us that are interested in from the Laguna on down. I know that, and I see Randy Leach here from the county, that we are cooperating with the county, and I want to encourage that because this is going to be we're not going to do it by ourselves, and we're not going to do it in a vacuum. So this is information that we want to get as much of it out as fast as we can so that people understand that there is really good, solid information here, particularly the stuff that you're developing with I don't even understand a pathogen chip, but that's okay as long as I get the information out of it. Because we have for those of us that have been involved in it, we've just spent so long trying to explain. No, this is human. This is not from the weasels and the bears. They're gone. So gotta be something else. It is encouraging to see the work go forward, and I realize that you're going to be hampered by budget and everything else, but I want to, for those of us that are in that area, and I, as I told Brenda, I think you're going to like what you see, and I certainly am, and I think she, I can see the smile. Yeah, this is it's about time, so thank you very, very much.
And I just want to throw in thanks also to Sonoma County, because they've been really helpful in the GIS map that Charles showed, trying to get that information, you know, helping us with that. So we appreciate that a lot.
Steve, I got a question. In talking about the monitoring program for the Russian River, you said that we're going to need another season for monitoring out there. I think that's going to help better characterize existing conditions and validate our management questions. But it seems that there's other entities who have been collecting a lot of information out there, County Health, Sonoma County Water, watershed groups, and if those data are there and meet the whatever you set up for your QAQC protocol, are you going to be using those or looking at them, or have you looked? I mean, it seems like there's a wealth of information out there rather than that will fit into your study plan. But
one of the things that UC Davis did do alongside that pilot project is pull together all of that existing data into one database, and so we do intend to use that and add it to our own data. Some of the problems with that previous data is it's very limited. It's single samples.
Sure.
We have first flush data, which are kind of citizen monitors getting, you know, a storm
event.
You're
going to get a full spectrum of it.
And so that's the kind of information we need. We'll add that to what we do to see, you know, are we in the same range that they're seeing, or is there something different? I mean, those are all absolutely great, but we do intend to use all that previous data, and we have rolled it into one single database at this point.
Also, the sampling variability.
Oh, yeah. The sampling variability, I mean, knowing, you know, we're going to do everything in triplicates so that we can actually compute a variance of the sample that we're getting instead of grabbing a sample and going, well, you know, you grab two of them and you don't know which one's right. So it's really important for us to get some statistical strength and basis behind the sampling versus the single grab samples that, you know, may or may not tell you much.
Well, if there's anybody to develop that statistical study plan, I have full faith in your ability to do that.
Thank you.
Other questions? John, did you have any questions? Mr. Norman.
Thank you. It seems like you're horizontally integrated here. We've got the whole crew, and you do outnumber us at least by one. A couple questions. It strikes me that this is not necessarily a source problem. It's a not a point source problem, but it's a non-point source problem. Is that a fair characterization? Nodding heads. I don't expect one answer. It's okay. Just some observations from my standpoint. And Bill actually asked a question, the correlation to rainfall and how these go. I have an interesting observation in that I've done stormwater sampling, which I've reported before on Santa Rosa Creek with the MS4 program, and it's really interesting that high storm events, you just get wild numbers out there on bacteria, huge numbers, many, many zeros on the MPN per 100 mils. What's interesting, and Mona, with the new permit, the stormwater sampling, which used to be first flush and then qualifying events, and it was a composite sample over a three-hour period and all that, they're now grabs. And what's interesting about the grabs, and including the E. coli total and the Enterococcus, is the grab numbers, which aren't necessarily storm-related events, some are and some aren't, are much, much lower. So I would echo in my just limited observation of this is that it is very much flow and timing of event-type basis, at least from the bacteria part. It strikes me, too, that the Bacteroides sample analysis that was done here is the problem is us. It really is. It's the conversion of land, it's the septic tanks, it's everything else. It seems to me that in your presentation that the point sources of the various, I think there was 14 of them, that those are pretty well handled. There's a couple outliers which include Great and Occidental, which I would be interested to hear what we're going to do with those in a timely manner. They've been hanging out there for a while. I'm also interested of the graphic on Summer Home Park. That to me is daunting. A lot of our problems to me strikes me is that their pre-general plan carve up of land with, that wouldn't happen today under our general land use requirements, a general plan. You couldn't do that, but it's there nonetheless. And so, and yet sewering those districts out there are very expensive. And if you go in and try and do that, you're talking an immense amount of cost over a long period of time. I'm interested in how that works. Steve, you alluded also to the fact of, you know, some of these are grabs. Some of these samples are, you know, we have high numbers. I think the one on Redwood Drive up in Fitch Mountain is kind of that way. The issue that I have with that, though, is that we've listed things on small amount of data. And in some ways, I think it would be really great. These are already listed water bodies. It's not like I don't know if we relist them. They stay on that list until they come off. But it would be really nice to know, through that development of that sampling and monitoring plan, how does that system function in a variable, you know, flow regime or time in a year and that kind of stuff. And that sounds like what you're getting at, because, you know, we do list things on a very small amount of data, and the listing protocol's narrow, and you get on that list, and to get off of that list is dang hard. And I'm real interested in that. I'm real interested in how we go forward on that and have better information. It's going to be interesting. I live on the Laguna, actually, and I have a septic tank. I'm, you know, septic and well. I have heard the statistic in Sonoma County that there's somewhere on the order of 60,000 domestic water wells. That leads me to believe that there's somewhere about the same amount of septic tanks out there. My septic system, I would just divulge, was put in before we bought the house. It's permitted. And when Forrest gets to my part of land over there, I'm not going to be a red dot. I am not a red dot. I actually try and maintain it, but I would imagine that there are a lot of septic systems out there that are pre-general plan, pre-permitting requirement, and, you know, county reps, I would imagine for you it's daunting as well. Unless you have a complaint-driven process or something out there, then they exist. This is a big issue. And then I would circle back around. Brenda Edelman asked this morning, this is a flow issue. It's timing of flow, whether storm event or whether it's seasonal flow. And Brenda asked the question this morning in fairness to say, well, what happens with the biological opinion and the tweaking of flows in the lower Russian? And so I would pose that question again. What happens here with that? You know, they're talking about a management of a lower Russian regime by intent, which is fine. That's the way the biological opinion is going to go, and that's for a specific purpose. But yet the cross-current outcome of that is that what does it do to that lower Russian system? And by the way, do we also get to the point of a monitoring protocol and a sampling plan out there that maybe takes some of that into effect? I actually asked previously in previous meetings when we talked to, I think, to our executive officer about there's others out there doing sampling and monitoring related to that, those slower flow conditions over a period of time. I'd like to think that our design plan melds with that or enhances that or enhances that information set about what is that effect, because that is water quality and we should be there, and I would ask that we are in a big way.
And that's true. Many of the sites that we did add are based on the same exact locations that were being measured for that biological opinion analysis. Some of the sites showed some violations of these indicator bacteria, so we've included them in our task two of this study to get both wet and dry measurements at these and really expand the information at those same locations.
Rebecca, I also wanted to congratulate you as being TMDL unit lead and call you out for that. It's fantastic. Oh,
thanks, David. I got some big shoes to fill, don't I?
Well, you follow Mr. Matt St. John, which he moved on and up, and you're there, so congratulations. And I think you guys are going down a real good road. I would pose as a question on the outgo here is we do have a couple of treatment plants out there that are, in my mind, are hanging out there. One's Occidental, one's Grayton, and I would like to hear at least at some point along this discussion of when and where and how do we get to those. And thank you for your presentation, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay, any other board member questions? I don't have any speaker cards. I do have a speaker card.
All right.
Would it happen to be Ms. Edelman? You just hang on to that.
Thank you, and I wanted to reiterate that I am indeed very happy about the depth of the study of this issue and the fact that the problems in the Laguna are now also being linked to what is happening in the lower river rather than just looking at it in a vacuum. Our group, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee, has been working on the nutrient issue for 20 years. We brought this issue up in the early 90s extensively, and we were told that phosphorus was not a limiting nutrient. We were responsible for getting a study through a settlement agreement with the city of Santa Rosa that looked at phosphorus in the city's wastewater, which indicated that it was quite high and that it was theorized strongly that that was a limiting nutrient. So we are very pleased that this is being looked at, and in response to, I forget if it was David who asked about this or someone else, but the issue of whether the POTWs are contributing, I think that you need to, you know, study that phosphorus issue with the POTWs because it was an issue with Santa Rosa's wastewater. Now they're discharged because of the geysers project. Their discharges to the river are thankfully very limited now, so the impact is, of course, much more limited. One of the issues I did not hear brought up that I'd love to hear addressed is I'm not a scientist, but there are certain general things I've been able to pick up on over the years, and one is that nutrients very often reside in sediments, so that a discharge or existence of nutrients that appear in the water column in the winter could bind up with the sediments and get reintroduced in the summertime. So I'm very grateful that you're doing all these additional high-tech studies to determine where the water is coming from, and I assume in some cases where the nutrients are actually coming from as well. And certainly the bacteria, I wasn't at all surprised to hear that much of it was coming from the urban areas. I agree that we need to document what the contribution of lower septics are. I know that we're not totally pure in that regard, but I also know that because of the high cost of dealing with the issue, it's very important to identify the extent of the problem in certain areas. And I agree if there's a big problem in a focused area that has to be dealt with. And I'll just say that I've been going to meetings in Monterio, and there's a very responsible group of local citizens there who have been meeting on this issue. And I think they've been getting a lot of information and trying seriously to address it. Of course, what keeps coming up is the money issue all the time, and I'm not sure how that will be dealt with. I'd also just briefly like to say, one other thing. I didn't hear a lot about riparian, but I think that really deserves a lot of focus, especially in the Laguna area, that riparian vegetation is a filter for so much of this, and the more trees that can be replaced, especially in the Laguna area, I think that would be very helpful in addressing these issues. And just finally, I'd say we have a lot of contact with the community. We do mailers, we do articles in the paper, and I definitely want to work with your staff on this and as closely as I can. It's an issue I really care about, and I think, you know, we can work together and greatly improve the situation. And we see this as a very positive effort, and we want to help in whatever way we can. Thank you.
Thanks, Brenda. Any others? Okay, thank you all very much. And with that, the board is going to recess for lunch.
Mr. Chair, do you want to do closed session over lunch?
Yes, thank you for reminding me. We will meet in closed session for lunch, and we'll just round it, so we will be back here at 1:30.